Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and joining me, of course, is the man behind Danwei.com, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. How are you on this lovely spring day?
I'm very well, Kaiser. Haven't seen you for ages, at least not since last night.
Right. So yeah, on this we're doubling up this week. We have a surfeit of terrific guests. We've got a really good show for you today. Christina Larson, contributing editor to Foreign Policy, joins us to talk about a terrific piece of hers that just ran in the magazine. It's called "The Startling Plight of China's Leftover Ladies." Welcome back to Seneca, Christina.
Thanks, Kaiser.
Also joining us is Tricia Wong, a cultural sociologist and ethnographer who's been in China for the past year on a Fulbright, working on a bewildering range of projects that she'll discuss with us in depth today. Welcome. How are you, Tricia?
Great. Thanks for having you on the show.
We are delighted that the timing of this worked out. I understand you've wrapped up your work and you're heading back to the States now.
Yeah, just for the field work part I'm wrapping up, but I will forever be coming back to do my research.
Oh, good, 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 good. Okay. Now, so before we jump in and talk about Christina's piece on leftover women, Jeremy, let's do a quick update on the very latest in the ongoing drama surrounding the Bo Xilai scandal. The rabbit hole just gets deeper and deeper.
Deeper and deeper. Well, yesterday we mentioned that Bo Guagua had a letter published in the Harvard Crimson in which he basically said that he wasn't a spoiled brat and he didn't ever drive a Ferrari. Today we had at least one new article with new information in it.
Right, the New York Times. This very, very strong piece. It was actually quite a tour de force out of reporting. You guys all saw it, Christina. Jonathan Ansfield had the byline along with Ian Johnson. And then Comrade Ed Wong did
contributed some reporting.
Yeah, contributed definitely to it. Basically, it contends that Bo Xilai wiretapped, actually Wang Lijun on Bo Xilai's behalf, wiretapped the phones of senior party leaders, including President Hu Jintao, and even Bo's ostensible ally in this whole thing, Zhou Yongkang. So the Times reporters say they had, close to a dozen sources confirming this. Of course, they were on allegations of wiretapping. Anyway, this was supposedly in an internal document that they had all seen. What did you guys make of all this?
The mess continues to unravel.
So I guess the big question in my mind, what this really raised for me was, because Gotti Epstein, who's a regular guest on the show, he and I were jousting a bit over whether the Haywood murder investigation was, in light of all this, just kind of a pretense, that perhaps it was actually the revelation of the wiretapping that really got him into hot water.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I talked to Jonathan a few weeks ago, and he's done some amazing reporting since, but it did strike me and others I know on a gut sense that Neil Haywood was a fascinating drama, but was this something really that the party would care that much about? And also,
Come on, it was a murder, my God.
Well, no, but when the sources came forth, dishing on this to, you never get leaks like that as a foreign reporter here. And so the sense is there must be a reason that they're pushing this out to the foreign press. And the reason must be, or could be, that they're trying to deflect attention from something else. We're all talking about whispers and rumors here, so I'm speaking freely. But I do think that Ansfield and Johnson moved the bar quite far along in pointing us to something else bigger that makes a lot of sense.
So Gotti was basically ribbing me today about a theory that I've been trying to peddle of late, which is sort of the application of Occam's razor to this whole mess. But this is before the wiretapping revelations. Basically, what I have been saying is that, I want to embrace the simplest theory that can really account for all the observable facts. And in this case, of course, the facts themselves are far from transparent to everyone. But I had basically concluded that after the shocking revelation that Gu Kailai had been charged in the murder of Neil Haywood, that we could understand basically everything that had transpired without resorting to all the other things that get trotted out all the time about, Bo's flamboyant, outsized personality and about his penchant for demagoguery or for, sort of neo-Maoist proclivities and all that. And even without resorting to talking too much about these, patterns of factional alliance. And my contention was that, had it not been for Wang Lijun's dramatic flight to the consulate in Chengdu and the alleged murder that he revealed, the party leadership just wouldn't have exposed such a major rift. They wouldn't have done that. They would have been able to paper it over and maintain that facade of unity that they've always done. So he thinks, though, that now this is really what it was about, that he, you know, I'm prepared to rethink my theory now in light of the wiretap. But I still think that, you know, look, a murder wasn't a straw that broke a camel's back. It was a freaking grand piano dropped on the back.
Sure. Well, I do think in a way that you're both, or could possibly be both right. I mean, I think it was the flight to the consulate.
That's not possible.
Well, in this particular, if not in a cosmic sense, right? But I mean, I do think the flight to the consulate gave a good reason for party officials to discipline Beauchelet.
I mean, I think that the flight to the consulate meant that they couldn't keep it secret.
Right.
If there was no flight to the consulate, all of this would have been kept secret.
It's going to get blown out no matter what. I mean, there's too many paths of leakage at that point. I mean, the Americans know about it, and we know how good they are at keeping, you know, diplomatic cables.
U.S. consulates, yeah, they have a great reputation for protecting their sources, don't they?
Well, please join the man outside.
I chose the wrong area of research because this is much more exciting.
It only happens once every 30 years.
We have to. We're obliged every week to do the Beauchelet saga update. And we'll move on right now and talk about something much more important, which is, of course, the plight of the leftover ladies. So those of our listeners who haven't actually read your piece yet, Christina, what is a leftover lady, a leftover woman, and how widespread is this phenomenon? And why do you describe their plight as startling?
Okay. It's a story that's in the current issue of the Foreign Policy magazine, which is actually our first ever sex issue, largely about women, the Middle East, gender politics. But this piece is about women in China who are dubbed shengnu, which basically means leftover ladies. And there's some disagreement about what exactly the term means, but either women above age 27 or above age 30 who are unmarried. And they tend to be women who are highly educated, live in cities, high earners. And one might think, especially given the I think something like between 20 and 30 million more men than women in China, that how could it possibly be that you see these very eligible women saying they can't find a husband or they can't find a suitable husband? So the piece was really an exploration of how, on the one hand, is there a male-tipped gender balance in China, and on the other hand, you have this sort of parallel to Sex in the Cities, which is women in their late 20s and early 30s who have careers, are unmarried, and say they don't want to be that way.
So, Jeremy, are you hearing this? call me crazy, but I just don't
see
it as a problem.
Sorry, Kai.
I mean, a surfeit of single, educated, professionally successful women in their late 20s and 30s abound, I mean, here in China cities. Jeremy, do you see a problem with this?
Well, no. If I was single, I wouldn't see a problem with it. I can see the problem from the point of the women.
Right, of course.
You're being mean.
Right. Well, I mean, by way of explanation, it's similar in some ways to what we see in the U.S. There was a cover story last fall in the Atlantic Monthly called All the Single Ladies that a woman named Kate Bullock wrote. Now, Kate Bullock is 39. She lives in New York. But she sort of interweaves her sort of history of what marriage is supposed to be about with her own personal dating woes. And it really sort of caused a sensation. And so I thought, you know, one of the things I did is I showed this article to some of the Chinese women I interviewed and said, you know, what if this resonates with you? And there was one line that one woman who's a reporter here for Magazine of Beijing, she's 30 and 5'9", totally gorgeous. I went to meet her and I was like, oh God, I feel very small and shabby meeting you. In other words, she's not your sort of prototypical old maid. And the line that she pointed to in that piece that really, she said, resonated with her was, and Gloria Steinem said in the 1970s, we're becoming the men that we thought we wanted to marry. She probably didn't know how much that line resonated.
Wow.
So it was Kate Bullock who's quoting Gloria Steinem. And then I asked the Chinese woman, Annie, I said, you know, what do you think about Gloria Steinem? And she said, who? So she really wasn't sort of pledging her allegiance to this American feminist item. But this idea that women have come so far in China that their standards are rising, this is something I heard over and over.
So it's a good thing. I mean, that's what I think.
I don't feel sorry for these women. They're more Condi Rice than they are Bridget Jones.
That's good. Now, I mean, Trisha, you've been out in the sticks more than certainly than any of the rest of us. Are you seeing this sort of problem reflected there? Are the women outpacing the men in terms of their personal development? In terms of, that's a certainly phenomenon that I think I would attest to here in Beijing, certainly in Shanghai too.
Well, I see similar things happening in terms of you see more women who are single But it, what's different from the women in Christina's story is that they're largely uneducated and they don't have a stable income. So they're really in situations where they've been slighted and they've been wronged, or either they have been left, or because either because the successful migrants who come into cities, these men and women also, they change their aspirations. So sometimes the aspirations of these males, these husbands who are supposed to be loyal forever, and then you're supposed to go back to the village and you know, raise your child there and send all your money back and then eventually go back and retire and die there. That story isn't really happening with this this wave of migrants. You know, they're going to the cities and they actually want to stay there. And then they find out, wow, the city has a lot more to offer, like more women or more temptations. And so a lot of these women are ending up in single and they're divorced, but not because they want to be, you know, and so they're really stuck in terms of, I'm in between, we have to raise this child. But for women in a village, when you marry, you go to your husband's village. You are pretty much essentially your husband, you know, in the village of your husband. But when that divorce happens, it's a really big shakeup because these women really feel like, I don't have a home. I can't really go back to my own home because I'm a female, I'm a daughter, and I already, you know, was given up. And now I don't have a home here. So it's just, and there's always usually drama. You know, rarely do you get the mother and father-in-law who is very compassionate to your case. And it could be that you're being, and it's very different if you're divorcing with no children versus divorcing with a female baby, or if you're divorcing with a male child. So you have different kind of power depending on what the gender of your first child is. You're really screwed as a female if you are being divorced with a first child as a female, because then neither side usually wants you because you don't have a lot of power to negotiate.
Right.
Why is it changed? I mean, is it different than it was a generation ago, this wave of what you're talking about?
Is it different from a generation
ago?
Yeah,
I mean, you talked about this wave of migrants having different aspirations.
Well, there weren't those sorts of migrants a generation ago, right? You didn't see that sort of mass migration out from the countryside, which is often led by women.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe like 10 or 15
years ago. You have the first wave of migration is what you call just like they come to the city, but they still go back to the village.
Right.
So there's a tie to the village and a tie to the village traditions, and the influence of the family is much stronger. Or only the husband goes and sends the money back. But right now you have both people, you know, either going to the village or one going and then one saying, let's stay in the city. We don't want to go back to our village, either because they just don't want to, or because their land is going to be taken, or because of, you know, the government taking over the land, or some kind of development happening in the village.
Do you see something happening where things could change in China because women are becoming more economically powerful? Because it's not only in the cities where women make money. I mean, a lot of factories prefer to hire women. A lot of the migrant workers working in factories are women. Is it not possible that we will see some kind of new dynamic because of
a good dynamic. I mean, a genuinely empowering dynamic.
Perhaps not so good for rural men, but for women, an empowering dynamic.
I think it cuts both ways. I mean, I think there's so many things happening at once. I mean, on the one hand, the fact that women are more able to be independent and stay single, at least in the cities, is, you know, a testament to their sort of economic success.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of, you know, I think in some ways, you know, Gaokao scores, and in some, you know, business achievements, women are making progress. In terms of politics, obviously, there's an article very recently in the Wall Street Journal about how women are losing ground in terms of representation and, you know, political leadership. Economically, I think, you know, I'm mentioning this just because it's something I've recently been talking about with Lita Hong Fincher, who's a PhD sociology student at Tsinghua. And she was saying that in part because of the anxiety about getting married, you know, and a lot of the pressure is also from your parent, that it's still the case that men are more likely to insist and women are more likely to except that only the man's name is on the property deed for an apartment. And so she's done some research saying that over the past 10 or 15 years that women have largely lost out on the wealth
economic
accumulated through property because of this. And, you know, and at least now we're having a discussion about it. I mean, the marriage law, the change in the marriage law last year is not favorable for women, but people are beginning to sort of talk about and recognize these things. But I think that Jeremy's sense that women are, you know, this is such a hard, you know, thing to it's such a big statement, but a lot of the women I met here are extraordinarily steely, and they're steelier in a sense even than some Western women, because it's like they were expected to do one thing to get married and they've not, and they've in a sense are further from social expectations, and so it's tough in them, the ones who've decided, you know, this is how things are going. And I think, you know, again, among at least in the larger cities where there's a peer group of other women who are professionally successful and haven't married, they support each other. And so there's, mm-hmm. you know, that reinforces them and allows them to sort of devote their time and energy to things that they care about or can be successful at. So I think, these are obviously very positive trends.
Sure. It cuts both ways. Now, one of the things that you touched on, and you made reference, of course, to this very, very popular dating show that's been, talked about all the time, you know, Feichang Wura, and the memes that have come out of that, you know, I'd rather cry in the back of a BMW than smile on the back of a bicycle. You know, it seems that a lot of women have rejected the naked marriage and embraced instead naked materialism. I mean, it is now sort of a commonplace that a man is expected to own a home and own an automobile.
Sure.
If you look at the rates of home ownership and of actual automobile ownership, I mean, that is, obviously that's not a lot of then marriageable candidates. Isn't this part of the problem?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we want to call it a problem, it's that women's expectations are rising, and now dating shows like this reinforce the sense that, you know, you should hold out for the very best, and the very best is a very small percentage of the actual pool of men that exist in China. So you're right that women's own sort of standards and insistence on these things is contributing. I do think there's such a great divide between whether you're sort of on the winning end or the losing end, and you know, to marry. I mean, women in any country may marry someone for material gain, but the difference between marrying a winner and marrying a loser in China economically is so great that I think that just
That's a good point.
Yeah. intensifies the sense of the pressure. And one other stat, actually, that I just wanted to make about sort of
material motivations.
Or, you know, I mean, again, material motivation, it could be that because somebody's successful and educated, they're interesting and stimulating. So it's not all as crass as necessarily I want, you know, a house and you know, a fur coat. One of the demographers I talked to at Tsinghua had done an analysis of the 2000 survey, and he found that among men who are age 40, who were in the highest income and education bracket, only 1% were single at 40.
Mm-hmm.
Of men also age 40 in the lowest income and education bracket, these are mainly rural men, fully 25% are single.
Right.
So it really and truly is the guys on the top of the pyramid, it's sort of a winner take all, top of the economic pyramid, aren't having trouble finding women. And when you hear about the bare branches and excess bachelors, it really is.
I think if you add in all the de facto concubines as well, from the men at the very top of that pyramid, you'd end up with an even more frightening number.
Yeah.
1.8
There's too
women.
Many permutations.
That's right. You mentioned demographer that you talked to. What are the demographic implications for this? I mean, does this mean even lower rates of childbirth and exacerbation of demographic threats that China's already facing that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago with Tanya Brannigan from The Guardian?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And so there's even going to be lower fertility rates as a result of increasing, you know, later and later marriages, right? Yeah.
Right, right. And then also, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that in terms of sort of provision of social services, that you really are going to have a concentration of unmarried bachelors in the poorest parts of China. So it's going to be even harder to provide for them than if you had a bunch of unmarried bachelors in,
right,
say, Shanghai.
So these are the reasons that the government takes this so seriously? And do you think this is also the reason why the media seems to treat this as such an issue?
Well, come on. Everyone loves talking about love and sex. That's why.
Sure.
One reason the media loves to.
That's why foreign policy decided.
This isn't a hard story to sell to the media. You know, it's the All China Women's Federation, you know, has spent quite a bit of time doing a 30,000 person survey, of leftover ladies. So that's one indication that, you know, at least one sort of quasi government body is taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to. I mean, there are programs, of course, to try to encourage you know, to say it's a fine thing if you have a female child as opposed to a male child letter run by the government. It's hard to say that the government has really tried to address this in a meaningful way. It's such a quite complicated thing.
Right, right. Well, everyone make sure to read the story. It's on Foreign Policy, and it's called, once again, the startling plight of China's leftover ladies.
Startling plight.
Are we all startled? Let's get startled now with Tricia here. Tricia, you've done a lot of different ethnographic studies in your relatively brief time here. I don't even know where to start, but what is the thread that you would say ties them? I mean, these are apparently very disparate, you know, these research topics that you take on. But is there a single thread that ties them all together?
Yes, I eventually found out the thread.
so
for my own sanity, is I'm looking at the changing conceptions of trust in China, and looking at how people come to acquire information, so how they think about information, and then how they come to act upon information. And then all of that is, how do you place trust in the information you acquire when especially you can't see someone face to face, and so much of social interaction is now happening online.
Okay. So it's about the trust that people place on information that they receive, whether that's coming from online, whether that's coming from traditional sources.
Can we be a bit more specific? I mean, I think you refer to Tricia as the ethnographer of the underclass. I mean, isn't it true that most of your work is focused on people who are very poor?
The down and outs.
I do. That's a big portion of my work, is looking at disadvantaged communities or marginalized communities. But I'm also looking
at
students.
That's what we call poor people in English.
Yes. The people who are screwed, get screwed over by the system.
Yes, people are screwed. Yeah. Right. Okay.
So I focus a lot of my time on that, because that's just always where my heart is. But I'm also looking at, I realized that this year, when I came to China, I hadn't been here for 1 year. And something fascinating happened, was that Weibo happened, social media happened. All of a sudden I was like, well, I have to expand. I have to be where the people are. And right now these stories are also coming from students about changing conceptions around desire. And that's happening across the board, is like how people are remaking how they see desire and sexuality. So that's a large part of my research too.
So let's march through a couple of these. Your specific projects. Maybe it'd be best to start with your most recent work. I understand that you were just back from Hunan, right?
Yes.
Where you were looking at a couple of different free lunch programs for rural schools.
Yes.
And one of them, one of them was a grassroots one organized by on Weibo by Deng Fei, the journalist. And the other was a government-funded, government-organized program that sort of followed in its footsteps, right?
Yeah.
And so you were able to sort of compare this grassroots effort to. Tell us about that.
So Deng Fei is a journalist, a pretty well-known journalist in China, and he's the first to kind of reveal the kidnapping cases and also a lot of abductions of females in villages. And so recently he calls himself the angry journalist that became a loving and caring journalist. And now he focuses on developing this program called Free Lunch, and it's the first kind of grassroots donor program that's successful on Weibo to this scale.
Mm-hmm.
And over 18 million renminbi has been donated from 1 million donors for students to have a free lunch in really rural, kind of poor areas. And this is really amazing, because it's happening all just on Xinlan Weibo, all through people who, recently. It all happened around the time that the Red Cross, the Guomemei case happened. So
right.
This is in time of
trust eroded.
Trust eroded.
Well, which, if we may, just like for listeners who may not be familiar with the intricacies of the Chinese internet, the Guomemei case was the young lady who claimed to be a Red Cross employee and seemed to be somehow connected with the Chinese Red Cross, who had a Maserati.
And she was just flashing a lot of bling.
It was followed up by a lot of other crises about the Red Cross.
Yeah, and
nobody in China
donations
trusts.
Of blood dropped off precipitously as a result of this. It was very sad.
Blood and money.
And money. Blood and treasure, as we say.
Yeah, blood and treasure. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and then happening, yes, and exactly. So all the more fascinating that happening at the same time was this major spike in donation online from people who, distrusted.
Will trust a person that they kind of know on Weibo much more than an organization.
Right. Or even these people who have donated don't even know who Deng Fei is. So that's the fascinating part of why I wanted to know.
We're talking 18 kwai a person, though.
Three kwai. Right.
What did the solicitation say? How did they ask for donations?
They said, this is exactly, there's children starving in rural areas and they are not getting a free lunch. So
who says there ain't no such thing as a free lunch?
Right? Yeah. So they, and people donate it. But this is the, what I found out what's happening is that each school is required to create a Weibo account. So there's 160 schools that participate right now so far. And each school, if you're going to get a free lunch, you have to post, you have to make all your financial accounting completely transparent. So every day you have to post exactly how many, the weight of the meat or the food that you bought and how many children ate and how many, and exactly how much you spent. And these teachers in these areas have may have never even, you know, used Weibo before. Most of them haven't. Actually, none of them have. And they sometimes have to spend up to an hour to half hour writing this 140 character message, posting their, you know, finances online. And
I'd rather go hungry.
Well, then you can talk to these children.
I'm joking. I just
said like a man who works for a large company and doesn't have to do his own accounting.
Oh, I don't know, dude. I dread it. That's terrible. I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to interrupt with that just facetious idiocy, but go on.
So, and so then what also, what he also does is that he gets what I find fascinating is that he's essentially what I call like hacking materialism, where a lot of people are now posting what they own online and they're auctioning it off. So they're very open about what they own. Like, I have this, you know, jade, you know, vase that is worth this much, and now I'm starting an auction, and whoever buys it, you know, I will donate the vase and you know, the money to free lunch. And people are just posting the stuff that they own from the houses where before.
It's like a jujitsu move where you're leveraging somebody's like urge to their status consciousness, right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow. That's kind of scary. I mean, it actually reminds me of another piece of work that you were doing. You work with sex workers. One person that you focused on was this famous or infamous Liu Mangyan, right?
Yes.
Who, I mean, let's just give everyone a little bit of background on who she was. She really walks the talk in terms of advocacy for sex workers' rights, because she actually went and became a sex worker, at least.
Let's trace it back. I first encountered her in 2004. Online.
Right.
yeah, we're wondering about encounter.
Yeah, the way you look at me.
Well, sure.
I saw her.
Tell us about this encounter.
Liu Mangyan's first blog was basically pictures of herself
naked right.
online. And that was about it, really. That was way back when in 2004. So she's been writing and posting about sex-related things for a long, long time.
Right. She actually went and became a sex worker for a day, I believe it was just a day, and wrote about it like hour by hour, you know,
partner by partner,
right, on Sina Weibo. And let me be upfront here. I mean, I actually was very uneasy reading those posts. I couldn't help but question her motives. I mean, it was like this kind of disquieting combination of sanctimony and exhibitionism, or kind of this exhibitionistic martyrdom, which
like most Chinese dissidents,
reminds me quite a bit of this whole, you know, you know, showing off your bling and auctioning it. It's like, you know, I'm sacrificing this jade vase that I have, but I have this jade vase. It's like,
I'm sacrificing
the way that she wrote body. About it. It's like, you know, right now she says, oh, and this young man was so astonished to gaze upon my white, beautiful skin, you know, and it was very strange.
I got uncomfortable as you said that.
Yeah, it was. Very, very. Anyway, how did you get connected with her? I mean, I know how Jeremy encountered her online.
I saw her blog. Let's just be very clear about that.
Well, I also saw her blog, and then my friend Jinga, who uncovered the gold farmers case, World of Warcraft gold farmers case, actually introduced me to her. And so we became friends. I've known her for several years and have been following her and just researching her. And she's done, I call it what she's done, you know, really extreme ethnography, going in and really doing the work all the way.
Do you think that it was impactful? Do you think that, I mean, I think when I saw reaction online, it was mostly sort of in line with mine. It was a sort of, you're just doing all this act of public martyrdom and there's something inherently perverse about it.
Well, from her point of view, you guys, what I think everyone should understand is that here you have a female from a village with no college education who has no one to guide her way through this. I mean, she doesn't work with a community of sex workers. She doesn't have any kind of academic background. She has divorced, you know, is just this woman from a village who happens to care a lot about these women because of her encounters. And her from her point of view, she feels like that China's stability, and actually goes really well with Christina's article, is that from her point of view, for social stability to happen in China, you have to make sure that everyone is getting laid, especially these men who cannot find anybody. So she thinks that the sex workers, the bottom, you know, not like the sex workers that get paid like 10,000 to a couple hundred thousand a day, but these who get paid like 10 kuai per sex or per blowjob, is that they are the ones who are making society stable. They carry on the weight of this gender and population. And so we should have rights for them. Like, they should not just be, you know, penalized for what they're doing, because they're keeping society stable. And so she really feels for them.
So she's for legalization and, you know, making it a protected or a regulated industry, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, Kaiser, to whatever degree she knows what that means. Yeah.
Kaiser, you may feel uncomfortable about it, but don't you think, if I may ask Tricia, I mean, that Liu Mengyan is sort of a part of a tradition that maybe goes back to the legendary Pan Jinlian. But, you know, there are other people like the sexologist Li Yinhe, like Mu Zimei, who was the first sex blogger in China, who, to me, the very important social function they play is to expand the space in which women are allowed to
express sexuality,
their own bodies, right. Basically.
Exactly. And that's how she feels, because she's like, well, why should I be embarrassed of putting my body up? You know, this is just a body, like, so I'm going to put it up.
No, I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that at all. I mean, and I actually have no problem with advocacy for sex workers' rights and everything. It's just that there was something creepy about the way that she went about it.
The exhibitionism.
Right. Well, that and yeah. I don't know if you read the actual posts, but they were... Okay.
I did, yeah.
And those, the two, you know, the, some of the people she slept with were men who she said could never have not been able to get sex, you know, or... because they're, you know, the leftover ones who are too old in the 50s, or this kid who's, you know, 18. From her point of view, she was doing a service and right. trying to get people to see, like, there's no, what she described to me in detail is like, there was no way I could have found that out unless I went inside and did it. And so it was very important, I think, from her point of view, to let people know that this is not easy work, and that when you're doing, you have to worry about, you know, getting caught by the police. You have to worry about, you know, are these men going to kill you or not? And in the safety conditions. I mean, she wrote about it all. How do you make negotiations with the mommy who runs the brothel? Mm-hmm. And how do you negotiate the price, like down to the cost of the room to rent? Everything. How do you clean each other off? Like, what are the rituals involved in this? And it's very intricate. And she was like, well, there's no way else anyone would have told me. You know, I had to go and find out so that I could expose, like, just how difficult their lives are.
Jeremy, isn't Zhang Lijia writing about prostitution in China right now?
I don't know, actually.
Okay, I think last time I talked to her, I think that's her forthcoming book. I'd be really
interested. But that, I mean, that is the great fascinating subject of China that nobody has really done a good book on, is prostitution in China.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a very, very
and Liu Mengyan was the first to also like hold a hotline for sex workers. You know, she went and just opened up a hotline about 5 years ago, and just whoever wants to call me, I'll talk to you about your problems. Hmm. And she wasn't doing anything with their stories. And what she told me was that she feels like if someone else could just take over her place and do this, she wouldn't have to keep doing this. Because she's like, I really don't know what I'm doing. I'm just doing it. You know.
Do you feel like there are people stepping up now and?
No one, I think, is really advocating for a sex worker. I don't know of anyone really who's willing to take this on. Right. And from her point of view, the important thing is, from her point of view, there's no one who said, I will actually, you know, fight for sex worker rights.
What about sex workers themselves? I mean, that was the other thing about this, is that there seemed to be like this sense that they couldn't possibly have agency themselves.
Right.
Like it requires me to come in and
exactly. And that's why she feels the pressure, because none of these women would reveal that they are a sex worker. There's so much shame involved. That how can they go back to their families to tell them what they do? And so she's the one who will go. You know, there was a case in Guangzhou where a sex worker was caught, and the police actually wanted to parade her down the street as a way to punish her. And mm-hmm. she went in herself, went and took the train to Guangzhou, and went to the police station. There's no way you can do this. If you do this, her family, you know, she'll be shamed forever. She'll never be allowed back in her village. And she convinced them to not do this. And this is, you know, no one's paying her road fare or anything. She just did it. And these are things that may not, you know, get as much press.
Right. There's nothing objectionable there, certainly. Let's move on. Hers was a sort of act of performance art.
That one act, right.
That certainly. And you've looked at other performance art projects sort of as social protest or as means to affect social change, right? Like the Occupy Men's Bathroom movement. That was another thing that you looked at in the course of your search.
Right.
Tell us about that. What did you learn about this sort of new trend of sort of flash mobbing for
Well, what's fascinating is that I've been looking at performance art, kind of under the underground performance art movements and activities. And it's really not called performance art. It's more like, I don't even know what
Situationism is what they used to call it.
Yeah, situationism. Right.
Okay. So like these situational campaigns, whatever you call it, right, for a specific like social change that they want, that people want to have, want to see. And so I participated in the Occupants Bathroom event in Wuhan that actually also happened in Beijing and Guangzhou. And in Beijing, it was prevented from happening. The police stopped it because they found out about it. And so what these people wanted was that the women wanted, they thought that, women and men who participated in the event thought that in China that these women's bathrooms are too long, and for, especially for the gender population. In other countries, you have more women, females, more stalls for in the female bathrooms, and they just want to see more stalls being built for a women's bathroom. It was very simple, and this is one way we went in. They went in. I went with them as a participant observer, and they took over the men's bathrooms, and they encouraged women to go into the men's bathrooms. And this is, but the fascinating thing is that, you know, this is only for about 3 minutes, you know, when it happened. Like, if you read about in the papers, you think, oh, it was like a couple of hours, maybe hour a day, but, or a flash mob, but it's actually exactly opposite from the flash mob. The whole goal of these kind of situations is to keep it as short as possible and to not have as many people, to keep it as small as possible. You don't want people to come. You don't want people to show up.
But you want the press.
But you only call specific press to show up because the journalists will write about it. So this was the fascinating part, is that a part of all these campaigns that
have you just blown their cover?
I mean,
have
you just... The target is the press, who will then write about it, and then they will populate it.
Don't you think this isn't a particularly Chinese problem? I mean, in nightclubs across the world, guys kind of can get in and out in a few minutes, even when there are people doing cocaine in the stalls, whereas women are always queuing out the back of the women's toilet. Isn't that a global problem?
Well, I think women's bathrooms are always long everywhere, but seriously, it's worse here. And then they were able, and it's really interesting the way they pulled up this. They actually had the statistics ready for the press to quote. You know, I'm really interested in how they construct that this is a problem.
What were the backgrounds of the women?
These are all college students. Okay. So that's the fascinating part. So these college students usually have time where they're either younger or either 20 to 25.
Were you able to talk to any of the originators, the organizers of these movements?
Yeah.
What was, I mean, do they have a history of activism, or are they?
Some of them, this was their first time. A lot of them, they are females, and they've advocated for other female rights. Like, for example, the recent stuff around that employers ask discriminate against women for having babies. You know, for having pregnancy.
Right.
So they've done some kind of, staged public campaigns around that. Or what they've done, this organization, this loose organization, they don't even want to call themselves an organization, is what they've done is they participate in a lot of hepatitis B campaigns, where now, before it was actually legal to discriminate someone if you have hepatitis B.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's actually legal. So there was a legal change. So they want to affect change through legal routes, but first they want to raise social awareness around. So it can also be something as simple as like that a bus doesn't announce the stops in a city. So they will go on to a bus, like one of the recent campaigns was, they go on and they just start announcing the stops themselves. Because their thing is like, if information is not transparent, if a new person comes to the city, they don't know where the stops are. This is not good for a city.
These people are organizing by social media, how are they organizing?
Everything, social media, QQ, message boards. And it's just, and some of their things may seem silly, but what I think it really represents and points to is this massive energy among young people that they want to make some change and it's possible for them. That the fact that they will even go do it. And I'm really interested in the ones who don't participate, because there's so much fear around participating in these things also.
Let's go on. There's so many other things that you've done. Let's just touch on a couple more of them. One is that you've done a lot of work with migrants, including migrants who'd gone to work at Foxconn in Shenzhen, which is, of course, very much in the news these days. What was your angle with the whole Foxconn thing? You were looking at how people find out about jobs or Is that correct?
So a lot of my research is around how migrant workers look for jobs, because that's the
information angle.
Yeah,
right.
For information angle. And a lot of them are switching through the internet to look for these jobs. And I was interested in the Foxconn case comes up because as I interview migrants, either they want to work there or they have already worked there. And so Foxconn is really like a country. It's hard to say that any one place can be, any one factory can be representative of all the factories. So when I talk to workers in Wuhan or Shenzhen or other places, you always get different stories.
Mm-hmm.
But the one consistent thread I think will surprise everyone, especially in the context of the Mike Daisy case around Foxconn, that he I don't know if people are familiar with it, but that he
yeah, I think everyone in the world.
Our listeners right? should be at least.
Yeah, okay, great. You guys all should know. Is that the workers are really happy to get into Foxconn. They get really excited. And what's exciting, what I hear, what they are excited about is that for these workers, they don't have to work through their guanxi, their personal relationships to get into the factory. That a lot of them are very proud that they got the jobs themselves and they were, it was not through a, how do you say hei zhongjie?
A black middle person.
Yeah. A black middle person agency that like kind of, you know, lies to you and wants a lot of money to introduce you to work. So, and a lot of them say, you know, this is the most, the contract, and this is the big thing they say to me, the contract that I got from Foxconn generally is what it says, like is what is done, like the whatever the salary is what I generally get. Of course, there's like little things that they do to get around the corners, like you're supposed to get paid overtime on Saturdays and Sundays, but instead they'll say you have Friday off, you're forced to take Friday off, and then you have to work on Saturday, but you don't get overtime pay. Right. So you get little things like that, but for them this is not a big deal. They're like, no, the contract says I get paid this, and this is what I get. And I'm like, and this is good. They're like, yes, this is a really big deal.
And what did you find out about, I mean, the changing way in which they are finding out about jobs? You think that it's because of these very, very large and generally well-regulated factories like Foxconn?
Better regulated.
That they're finding more institutional channels for information and more online channels for job information and not having to go through these, like, you know, hei zhongjie through guanxi networks, right?
Yeah, and also but also what you see is that some of the internet services for white collar workers are much more developed. Like you have Ganjiwan and Uba, but you don't have a lot of websites for these the migrant workers, right, to look for jobs. So one of the websites I've been really interested in is called Daguwan, and they're the world's first, you know, mobile based job search service for what they call blue collar workers. And this is really fascinating because their whole thing is like, you know, if you get lied to, we will compensate you for the first month of salary. Because their whole thing is like, in order for our service to work, we have to create trust that the information you find on our website will be completely transparent. And what they're going to do is they do have the service called Baosong, where they actually go into the factories and then they confirm that the room, you know, the number of people that have to share a room, or is there going to be air conditioning? They actually confirm what the corporation or factory says that they
the conditions.
So they go in and confirm this. So you have this change in transparency where corporations like Daguwan are going to in and confirming the information that they're getting from these factories.
How is Daguwan making their money? I mean, not to sound like a crass internet guy, but
they have investment. They have VC investment.
Investment is not revenue.
What's the business model?
The business models right now, they have really good VC money from American VCs and also Chinese VCs, and also
that's not a business model.
But their Baosong model, where they actually go in and confirm, and they say if a factory wants 1,000 workers, they want to be the middle person and says we will get your 1,000 workers because now right now there's a shortage in workers, so they're actually in a really good position where migrant workers and services like Dagu have the power to do this, so they have. So I was just checking out the website, daguu.com.
Okay.
Can I ask, coming from that, the internet use of the people, of migrant workers, since you've been doing this kind of study, what's the change? How important is the internet?
It's becoming more and more important, but what I see happening is one of the predictions I made this year was that what I saw last year happening was the beginning of smartphone penetration among migrant workers. And what I saw across the board was that even if I was at a massage parlor or at a restaurant, any kind of factory, out of 10 workers, you would have one person who had already invested fully 2,000 to 3,000 kwai in a smartphone.
Wow.
And that takes, you know, months of salaries after everything they send home to the family and save up for themselves. And so you would see all these workers around them kind of fetishizing, hoping to buy the smartphone eventually, you know, like their friend in a few months. And so I saw this happening over the last year. And then this year, what you have now is availability of the affordable smartphone. So really, it makes Zhangzai phones completely obsolete. There's no need for the Zhangzai phone anymore because you have affordable Android phones. And these workers are really, that's what they want because that's how they get online is through these smartphones. Other than the internet cafes, you know.
Do they use the smartphones differently than they'd use internet cafes?
Absolutely. Well, because the internet cafes, you can download a lot more video and You can play different kind of games differently. But also with a smartphone, you have more private viewing now. And so you have them able to like maintain their own conversations and ongoing conversations. Whereas before, if you go to the internet cafe, you can maybe only go once a week, you know, on your day off or something.
One of the things that gained a lot of notice, and I know a lot of people passed around links to it, was work that you had done with a migrant family a peddler family. They were selling dumplings, I believe, in a large Chinese city that you didn't specify. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Well, since I'm an ethnographer, I try and go in and as deep as possible, and I go hang out with people. So I lived with a migrant family. This time it was just for a week. The splice of the story was for a week's time, and that they were starting. They got a tip from a friend that there was a construction site without any
Chengguan,
the urban police management people that are known to be very hay and very horrible. And so they wanted to go in and sell dumplings there because if they could have a stable life there without having to run from the Chengguan, that's great. And so they went in, and I wanted to see what it was like to go and start a new business for a migrant street vendor and sell dumplings. And at the same time, I wanted to observe how smartphones were being used among construction workers, because it was at a construction site that they set up at. And so anytime you have a construction site, you always have secondary markets around, like sex workers or smartphones or clothes. And so I wanted to observe all of that.
The whole ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
Very interesting. And what were some of the big takeaways from that experience?
Oh, that it's very hard, a very hard life, and that you don't have a lot of time to do anything other than to work and to barely scrape by. And it's actually, for these families, everything for them is always on the line. But they're just so resilient. The takeaway is that they're very resilient. But what the big takeaway for me that's related to my research is that the family decided after that they don't want to rely on personal relationships for work, because they got the tip from a friend, but they realized it wasn't that reliable. And so the son in the family was like, well, maybe we should look through other channels for information for like potential work. You know, maybe we shouldn't just rely on friends.
It sounds to me like a few of the things you've talked about tonight is that we're almost seeing like the end of Guanxi as a business model for migrant workers, because the internet and mobile telephony are
information empowerment, right?
Yeah, that's a big thing. But I would have to say, like, if there's any big revelation in terms of, like, for me, for my research, I can confidently say, whereas before I was just guessing, you know, but confidently across the board, looking from students to migrants, this is change in the way trust is being negotiated in China, is that instead of within your social circles with people you personally know, you have this shift where there's not this moral obligation to only rely on your family and friends for work and for anything kind of information. It's this shift to your social networks or to people you don't personally know, and
these
to these
more anonymous horizontal networks, right?
Exactly.
Very cool.
And that's being helped through social media and sites like, you know, Baidu and like Youku and all these places.
But, right, places where I worked.
Yeah.
Let's make sure to tell us where we can start reading your stuff. Your personal blog is at.
My personal blog is blog.trishawang.com, but that's not as exciting. If you want to read, that's just like my thoughts on the off the cuff.
Okay,
but
so where do we read your
Bytes of China.com.
Bytes of China.com. Bytes of China, Bytes of China.com. We're really looking forward to what comes of this. Let's now move on to the recommendations segment of the show and wrap things up. What do you got for us? Why don't we start with you, Christina? Do you have something good for us this week?
There's a book called Concrete Dragon, and I was just looking up the subtitle. But it's by an urban historian. He's at the University of North Carolina, and he's done a really interesting sort of broad look at how urbanization is unfolding in China and some of the ways that sprawl and transportation are mapping differently than in the U.S. or Europe.
Okay, so it's a Concrete Dragon, and the author's name again?
Sorry, I was just looking it up on my phone. Thomas Campanella, and the subtitle, it's The Concrete Dragon, China's Urban Revolution and What It Means for the World.
Cool. Very cool. What you got, Jeremy?
I got two things. The first thing is a website that Tricia actually contributes to called
Ba-ba-ba.com.
And there, it's a group.
It could be,
it's a group blog, basically. We'll put a link up anyway.
Okay, please put a link.
And
don't
there
me.
Are Tricia and other interesting people, including the guy she mentioned who did the gold farming,
Jinga.
A few of the more interesting people one may have encountered on the China-related internet together doing a bunch of stuff. That's one. The other recommendation is some scholars and students and researchers at the University of Leiden in January this year sucked up every single tweet on Sina Weibo and stuck it into a database. And have you can now access this database of tweets from the whole of January 2012. And it's a great tool. If you're interested in the Chinese language, it's absolutely fascinating because you can rank the words by popularity. And I haven't had a chance to really play with it yet, but my one little observation, I kept on clicking from the first most popular word, which is de, like,
of course,
you know, well, de.
The particle de.
The particle de. I clicked through looking for words that actually meant something, that weren't just like me or you or is or, you know, really common words. And as far as my little experiment went, that I observed, the most common word that actually referred to something specific, a noun, was coffee, which, of course, is just great in the land of tea.
Yeah, that's interesting, and it's also just like you'd find on American Twitter, because everyone has to f-ing talk about, oh, I just haven't had my morning cup of coffee yet, or I'm having a cup of coffee.
Where do you find it? What is the university again?
The URL Leiden. Is one of these horrible university URLs.
But we promise
we will put a link. I don't remember the URL.
I think actually I have it, not handy, but I'll make sure that it goes up on the podcast page. Trisha, you got something for us?
Actually, I do. It's from my email because I actually am not online at all for the last year, really. But what I just saw is really interesting is from the McKinsey report. There's a whole report on social media use in China. So that seems like a really exciting one to
Yeah, read. Yeah, yeah. McKinsey does a good job on, well, on some things. And then
I'm sure your work is more interesting than anything they'd put out.
Thank
but,
you.
you know.
Okay, I'm gonna break rank here and do something totally non-China related. It's just that I happen to be listening to the Audible version of The New Yorker on the subway ride on the way over here today, and it's one of those rare things where I hear a book review and I'm just completely obsessed now with the book. And this does have to do with my friend here, Jeremy.
It doesn't happen that rarely, does it, Kaiser?
No, it does. It happens pretty, where I was like, I gotta buy this now. I wish, and I didn't bring my Kindle with me. And
are you recommending a book or a book review?
I am going to recommend a book based only on having read a positive review by somebody I trust, Philip Gurevich from The New Yorker. The book is called Absolution, and it's the author's name is Patrick Flannery. That's with one N, Patrick Flannery. And it's his first novel. And it's basically about two writers and they're coming to terms. And it takes place apparently in Cape Town, although the author is an American from the Midwest and has spent very, very little time actually in Cape Town, although apparently he sells it really authentically. Well, Jeremy, you'll have to be the judge of that, about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and about people coming to terms with the horrors inflicted on one another during apartheid and during the struggle against apartheid. Jeremy is looking at me with this incredibly skeptical face.
So the author is not South African?
He's not South African, right.
Okay, I'll have to read it before I...
Apparently it's doing well among white liberal South Africans from Cape Town. So
I'm only interested in black communist South Africans' opinion of books like that myself.
Okay. We'll find some black communist South Africans.
Not one in this room, unfortunately.
No. Anyway, hey, Christina, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Kaiser.
It's good to see you. And Trisha, bon voyage, and we hope to see you again soon. You'll be back in just a few weeks, right?
I'll be back. I have many stories to follow.
Good. Jeremy,
Kaiser.
Okay. And so we will see folks next week on Civica Podcast. Take care.